Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Welcome, everyone. This is Aaron with the Generation Y podcast, and joining me tonight is Catherine Casey. And I'm sure anyone who's a true crime reader is very familiar with her, but Catherine, perhaps you can fill us in on some of your more notable works.
Well, thanks, Aaron. I'm a journalist and I'm an author. I started out in magazine work, but since the 90s, I've been writing books. I just completed my 13th book, which is coming out in September. I write true crime books and mysteries, and I've written on all kinds of cases, from the Celeste Beard case in Austin to the Matt Baker case, the murdering minister in Waco. My most current book is the one we're talking about tonight, Deliver Us, on the I-45 Texas killing field murders.
Now, the I-45 murders, as you said, you write about them in Deliver Us. There are at least 20 victims spanning more than three decades. So we should get this out of the way in the beginning. We won't be covering all of the victims, all of the suspects, because we are talking about multiple murders here over a span of time. But I would say we'll focus on the 1970s, which is what your book starts off with. The I-45, it's quite a lengthy highway, but you focus on a stretch between Houston and Galveston, Texas.
It's about 50 miles, Aaron, and that's right. It's south of Houston going into Galveston and the area surrounding it. All of the murders didn't take place on or immediately adjacent to I-45, but they're in that general area. And in the book, I look at three decades, 1971 to 1997, and break it down that way. But as you said, we're looking at the 70s tonight, which was quite an interesting time.
One of the things that keeps popping up in these stories are tales of women who are looking to hitchhike, to travel somewhere, usually to have fun or to get home. And I know that early on in the book, you talk about your parents cautioning you about walking alone.
Well, I grew up in Wisconsin, and part of the time was during the in the 1970s when Richard Speck killed the nurses in Chicago. And there was also a girl around that time who disappeared, and her body was found later in Wisconsin, not far from where I lived. So my parents talked to me about being more careful. I used to go to the park and walk along, and I enjoyed it. It was a beautiful walk. And suddenly I wasn't allowed to do that any longer. At first, I went ahead and did it anyway. You know what teenagers are like, we'll do anything. But after a while, it started to sink in that after the Richard Speck case happened, and I saw it all over the news, that it wasn't always safe. And then I tried to be a little bit more careful.
Usually a shocking case, they say, has an effect on the community. It shatters innocence, whereas people used to keep their doors unlocked at night, and people would often travel alone, even younger people. That tends to change. Is that the kind of an effect that Richard Speck's attacks had on your community?
You know, I lived about an hour outside, away from Chicago, and it was all over the national news and the local news. And I remember how upset everyone was in the area at that time. I think it does change communities. I think it changes all of us when we see these horrible things in the headlines. It makes us feel uneasy. We feel less safe. As you said, we start locking our doors.
Would you say that this attack, knowing that a young woman was murdered not far from where you lived, did that possibly plant a seed for your interest in true crime?
You know, I wondered why that happened and who would do that. And in that particular case, now I was quite young, but I don't remember that they ever solved it. I don't remember anyone ever being arrested in that case. And I think it did a little bit. And the Speck case, and of course, this was the Ted Bundy years back in the 70s. So there seemed, that's when the, they started talking about serial killers at that point. That's when the jargon around, you know, serial killers started. So I think it did. It just kind of seemed to mushroom during the 70s.
Right. It certainly was a big time, especially with Ted Bundy. And when we have evil men like this, you could say, it puts a face on evil. And then you have more and more people focusing on these stories rather than a story of a woman who goes missing or is murdered, but you don't have a suspect necessarily or even someone they can arrest. So when you have a face like Ted Bundy's or Richard Speck's, it allows the stories to grow in the media and even in conversations among the people.
Well, and it makes you wonder who these men are. It's almost always men. Not always, but almost always. And, you know, what happened to them, why they ended up being the way they were, and why they were willing to take so many lives, and what drove them. So it's the psychology, I think, that's fascinating.
And before we get started on these series of murders in the 70s, on your website, you actually talk about what true crime means to you, your connection with it, and why people are so interested in it.
Well, you know, I think it gives you an insight into human nature. It shows the very worst that people are capable of, and it also shows the very best, because when I work on a book, I usually have one or two people that are questionable character, maybe one person that's very bad. But I meet a lot of people who do wonderful things. Certainly with this book, we're not doing the 1980s tonight, but in the 1980s, one of the victims was a girl named Laura Miller, a 17-year-old, who went missing and was missing for 17 months. And her dad's Tim Miller, and Tim Miller started Texas Equisearch. And he's dedicated his life to finding other victims, to finding the missing, to helping other families. So it's just really interesting to look at what people are capable of and how it affects the community and how it changes who we are and how it changes who they are.
Yes, it's quite amazing how someone can suffer such a terrible loss, but then they almost turn it into a strength because then they're able to go out and help other people who are hurting just like they are, but possibly they might be able to help them in time. Whereas when Tim Miller, for instance, his daughter was missing, there was no one to help him.
Well, that's very true. And, you know, when you look at motivations, I mean, this is a horrific thing to go through, and to be able to take that and turn it around the way Tim has. And so many other families I've met working on these true crime books over the years, they've had laws passed, they've started foundations. Some of them have scholarships in the victim's name. They look for some way to do something good, to make something good out of something horrific.
I would say one of the places in the book that is front and center is Galveston, Texas. Can you describe what Galveston was like during this time in the 1970s?
Well, you know, I love Galveston. It's this beautiful border island. It's quiet during the winters, but in the summers and the spring, it's just crazy. There are tourists all over the place. It's long and thin, and it runs right along the coastline just south of Houston. And it's beaches and condos and vacation homes. And a little farther up, there are a lot of, along the coastline of Texas, there are a lot of pipe jungles from refineries and chemical plants, and the cruise ships come into Galveston. And it's one of those places that's just a little bit on the wild side, Aaron, if you know what I mean. It's and at the same time, it's a very gracious and refined place. So it's and back in the 70s, it still had more of the innocence that the 70s held. Back in the 70s, when it seemed like the world was changing and young girls were getting into, you know, it was the Haight-Ashbury era, it was the hippie era. Things were a little wilder in general then, and they were in Galveston too.
People weren't as hyper aware of their surroundings. First young lady that we come across is named Colette Wilson. And on June 17th, 1971, she is waiting at the intersection of Highway 6 and County Road 99 in Alvin, Texas. What can you say about why she was waiting at this intersection?
Well, she just finished a band concert, and her instructor dropped her off there. The instructor had other students in the car to deliver to their houses, and Colette's mom was supposed to be there to pick her up. But, you know, they had like 10 kids, and Colette's mom was just running a few minutes late. She got there about six minutes after the band instructor dropped Colette off. And this was an era when parents didn't worry so much, as you said. And so it seemed safe enough. This was a country road, and it was, you know, not heavily traveled. And Colette's mom, Claire, got there, and Colette was gone. And she looked, and she went to a friend's house and looked for Colette, and she came back, and there was no sign of Colette. She had simply vanished.
You could almost understand why they would feel okay about dropping her off at that location, because it's out in public, and it's a road. So it's not like she was dropped off over by some fields or something. She's out on a road, and yet within a span of less than 6 minutes, because otherwise the mother would have seen something. When she pulls up, she's just not there.
When Claire pulls up, Colette's gone. Now, there is a car across the road, and she thinks she sees people in the car, but she just assumes that the car's broken down. So she goes ahead and goes to Colette's friend's house to try to find her. And when she's not there, she returns to the corner, but by then the car is gone and Colette still isn't there. So she goes home and calls her husband, and they immediately begin to look. And the response they get from law enforcement is the one many of the parents in my book got. They were initially told that Colette was probably a runaway. The Wilsons didn't believe that, but that's what police initially said. So for quite a while, for the first few days, the family looked, the neighbors looked, and the police didn't look.
Was there any feeling whatsoever that that car that appeared to possibly be broken down was actually involved somehow with this disappearance?
It's very possible, and I think Claire has wondered about that ever since. At one point, Claire was hypnotized, and they hoped that maybe she would be able to remember the license plate number of the car, but she didn't, so it didn't help.
It's such a terrifying thing, and it had to eat away at her knowing that that vehicle may have been the answer, and she dismissed it too quickly.
You know, it's one of those things in life, I think, Aaron, where every day we go out and we make snap decisions about things, and we don't usually anticipate the worst. So, and Colette did have instructions if she was out on the road and Claire wasn't there and didn't show up right away, she was to go to this friend's house. So Claire just assumed that that's what her daughter had done. It wasn't until she got to the friend's house and Colette wasn't there that she realized something was very wrong.
Yeah, that's a real question of whether she stayed there and someone picked her up there, or if she did head in that direction towards her friend's house and then was intercepted by someone else.
It's very possible that she'd walked off a little bit. There were ranches around there at the time. There was a cattle ranch not far away, and there were trees surrounding the road. You know, anything's really possible. We don't know what happened. All we know is that at that point, Colette was gone, and she was never seen alive again by anyone in her family.
Another common theme here, even into the 80s in these cases, is someone will disappear, and then the family will hear from law enforcement that, oh, they'll be back, they'll turn up. And it's amazing to me because no one knows that person better than their family. These law enforcement people, and I'm not trying to be too hard on them, but seriously, this is someone's life at stake, and they're being a little too dismissive and saying, they're just running away, or they're just off having fun, they'll turn up at some point. And there's, as we know, if you don't get your investigation started early, you're losing time, and pretty soon you're working so far behind that you may never find the answer.
Well, that's true. I mean, nowadays we put out alerts when a child is missing or a teenager is missing. Even when the elderly are missing, we put out alerts. But back then they didn't do that. You know, they just assumed, as you said, that most of the time that the kids were runaways. Most of the victims in the book are teenagers, and the parents almost uniformly heard that at first. And even when they argued, and like in Colette's case, she was a good kid, had never had a problem. There was no indication that she had any plans to run away. A lot of the girls have left behind purses and all of their money and have no, they've left all their clothes. There's no indication that they run away, but police have insisted that. And sometimes it goes on not just for days, but for weeks and months.
On July 12th of 1971, at the Pelican Island Bridge, and is this in Galveston?
Yeah, the Pelican Island Bridge goes over to another island. It connects Galveston with a much smaller island. And that day, there were some people painting on the bridge. There were some men out there doing some painting. The metal rebars and everything, and they saw something floating in the distance, and they watched it for a while, and it was just kind of the water was lapping the bridge, and all of a sudden one of them realized that it was a body, and when it got close enough to the bridge, they realized that it was the body of a young girl. So they called in the police, and she was brought out of the water, and at first they thought maybe she was in her late teens, but it turned out that it was Brenda Jones. Someone there recognized Brenda. She went to Catholic school on the island. She was just 14 years old.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Yeah, she had gone to the hospital to visit her aunt, correct?
She had, and she took the bus home. The bus driver later said that she took the bus back home again. The family lived in one of the projects on Galveston Island, and she got out of the bus and was walking toward her apartment, her family's apartment, which was just a matter of a couple of blocks. And somewhere between the bus, getting off the bus and arriving at her front door, Brenda was abducted.
If you look at these first two cases, in both of them, there's a very, very small window of time where these young women are abducted.
That's true. You know, it appears that somebody obviously was watching and saw them. A lot of these killers are opportunists. And if they see someone who's vulnerable, someone who's in a situation where they're alone and there's no one around to help them, they're very adept at moving in.
Now, Brenda Jones was African-American and Colette Wilson was Caucasian. Were the investigators at this point was anybody even connecting these cases, or were they just in different jurisdictions?
Well, they were in different jurisdictions. Colette was on the mainland and Brenda was on Galveston Island. And the cases were different enough that nobody really thought at first that there was any connection. It wasn't until it kept happening that they started to wonder if there was one killer.
Right. And back then, they didn't really share information across different counties, correct?
They didn't. You know, they're not doing that as well as I'd like them to today, to be honest with you, Aaron. But back then, they really didn't do it. And there was a tendency to be protective of their cases. So if one of them had a murder case, they often kept all of the information within their office, the confines of their office. And they didn't check to see what was going on in neighboring counties. We didn't have VICAP or anything like that back then.
So Brenda Jones, again, law enforcement seems a little dismissive, right? And the family, Jones's family, says she wouldn't just take off. There's a new baby in the house. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the night before they found Brenda's body, the family reported her missing. And you're right. They said, you know, there's this new little baby in the house and Brenda's so excited about this baby, she would not have just left. But they didn't start looking for her. And then the next day her body showed up on the shore. Now, Colette Wilson's body at this point is still missing. They don't know what's happened to Colette.
Since her body is still missing at this point, what do we know about Colette's parents? Are they doing anything to try and search, or do they just feel helpless because law enforcement isn't exactly helping them?
They're searching. They're searching every day. They have their neighbors are out searching. what the police are not doing, the family is doing. Every night they gathered around together with their children, and they prayed for Colette's return. And Tom Wilson, who is a dentist, chased every lead. He went to Louisiana. He went across Texas following leads that came in, and then came back and reported that they were false leads. But they were trying. The family was really trying.
Of all the missing girls in these cases, there are three pairs of girls who go missing. And the first pair are a couple of really close friends, Sharon Shaw and Renee Johnson. Can you tell us a little bit about what they were like?
Well, they were both 14. And they were a little on the wild side and a lot of fun. They were having a great summer. That was still 1971. And they were talking about running away to Malibu or up to San Francisco and joining the hippies up in Haight-Ashbury. And they were staying, going to concerts a lot and staying with friends. And they were having a very good summer. At one point, they were sleeping out on the beach in Galveston with friends. They just really were enjoying the whole free spirit of the 1970s. And then in August, they were down on the seawall and a friend dropped them off. And they were supposed to meet back up with her at 5 o'clock. And when she got there, they didn't come. And they didn't show up that night at her house. And pretty soon, their parents were looking for them, coming to the friend's house. And at first, she covered for them, thinking that they were off in Haight-Ashbury or someplace and enjoying life. And then she realized that they were truly missing. So it, and you're right, it's an unusual thing when people disappear in pairs like this. And in these cases, there are three of these pairs, and Sharon and Renee are the first pair.
Now, what was it about them that law enforcement was again dismissive, perhaps, of that there was foul play involved?
Well, you know, the fact that they were a little on the wild side played right into this thing about, well, they're just runaways. But there were people pushing these cases. Sharon Shaw's parents were both pushing. Renee Johnson's grandfather was a public official in the area, so he was pushing hard. He knew that his granddaughter wasn't a runaway. So it's not that people weren't looking, but, you know, they didn't find them. They had just vanished.
Well, it was also said that they smoked pot, that they were the type of girls who might just take off and just go somewhere for a number of days, that was suspected anyway, that they would do that.
Well, they were even, as I said, talking about running off to San Francisco. They were not excited about going to school that fall. So they had been making noises about taking off for the open road. So it played into the whole thing about, you know, the idea that they were runaways.
Well, it's too bad because this may have just been talk. I'm sure they dreamed a lot. And that was probably a dream. Oh, we could just take off and go to California and we wouldn't have to deal with school.
They sound like a lot of 14-year-olds, don't they, Aaron?
Right. I mean, why are we taking them at their word? I guess is what I'm saying.
No, it's true. And, you know, it's not like they had packed up clothing and taken it with them, or they found out that they had been amassing money to fund a trip. They left. They were missing, and nothing else was missing except the clothes they were wearing.
And was there a particular place where they may have been headed to?
Well, they often went to the surf shops on Galveston Island and down to the beach, and there was a community pool there. But that day, the last place they were seen was leaving a water skiing place on the island where a lot of the kids would go, and they would be driven in a boat to water ski around Offutt's Bayou, which is the first bayou after the causeway going onto the island. So they'd been there that afternoon, but it was too choppy to go out in the boat. So they had their swimsuits and they had taken off walking towards 61st Street and then simply just disappeared.
And of course, their friend, she was known to give her friends rides because she had a car.
That's true, but the girls really did like to hitchhike. Sharon and Renee both hitchhiked quite often. So sometimes they would even hitchhike when she was willing to give them a ride just because they thought it was a great adventure.
It's funny how times change. Nowadays, if you talk to a 16 or 17-year-old and just ask them, hey, would you hitchhike? They would probably look at you like you were crazy.
Well, the world has changed. And you know, for this, in this particular instance, for the better, our kids now understand. They're taught from little that you just don't do that. But this really was kind of a rite of passage back in the 70s. A lot of kids didn't.
Now, are there any witnesses stating having seen anything about their possible last location or possibly having been picked up?
Not with Renee and Sharon. All we knew was that they had left the ski shop that afternoon and were walking towards 61st Street, headed toward the seawall when they disappeared, and that they didn't show up when their ride was there at 5 o'clock that afternoon. And they, too, like Colette Wilson, just vanished. Their bodies weren't found for a long time. So for a long time, you know, the parents were looking.
So Colette is found, and where is she found at? And
well, Colette's found along with the fifth victim, Gloria Ann Gonzalez, who was a grocery store bookkeeper. She was 19 years old, so she was the oldest of the girls so far. And she left in October of 1971, walked outside of her apartment, got, you know, and was planning to go on vacation. And the next thing, and then the next day, her roommate reported her missing. Well, about a few months later, her body, Gloria's body, and Colette Wilson's were remains, because by then Colette had been missing for months, were found in the Attucks Reservoir.
And what is the Attucks Reservoir?
It's kind of a spill area. You know, we've been recently, I don't know if you've been following the news, but we've had a lot of flooding here in Houston. A lot of the city is low-lying areas, so we have retention and detention ponds all over the place. And this is an area that dates back probably 50 or 60 years that was set aside. It's low-lying, kind of swampy, and it's used to kind of hold back the floodwaters during, you know, hurricanes and tropical storms.
When the first remains were discovered, they didn't realize there were another set of remains close by until they started testing, right? Doing an examination of what they had.
Yeah, they found a body, and it had, and there were some teeth there. So there was a, it was odd because the body was not decomposed, but there was a skull there and the teeth had fallen out of it. And the skull had been out there long enough that the flesh on it had decomposed. At first, they thought that maybe animals had done that to the skull. So they took the remains, this one set of remains, to the medical examiner's office. And of course, back then, before DNA, the primary way that they identified bodies was to look at the teeth and the dental records. So they started to try to put everything together, and they realized that they had a tooth that did not fit in, you know, in the jaw. It didn't go. So they tried a couple of times, and then the medical examiner during the autopsy finally dawned on him that there must be two bodies, that they had a tooth from one body and remains from another. So they went back out into the reservoir and started looking again. And they were out there quite a while when they found a pile of skeletal remains. And there was a jaw and the rest of the teeth. So that day they put in a call. They also found a ring and a necklace that matched the description of what Colette Wilson was wearing when she disappeared. So they put in a call to her dad, the dentist, and he went out there and did something no father should ever have to do. He held that jaw and those teeth in his hand and looked at it and verified that it was his daughter's teeth because he had also been her dentist.
Yes, he said he recognized his own handiwork.
Yeah. Yeah, imagine how horrific that must have been for him.
I know it's been said, and I think it might have been by Tim Miller, who you cover in the 80s. I believe he's the one that said, it's really terrible knowing that your daughter has been murdered. But he said it's even worse when you don't know what happened and you're still waiting to find out if they'll ever find her.
Mm-hmm. That's true. You have no idea if the person is being held captive, if terrible things are continuing to happen to them. And you wait, like Tim said, every day, every time the phone rang, every time anybody knocked at the door. Every morning when he got up, he wondered if that was the day his daughter would come home or if that was the day he'd finally find out what had happened to her. It's a horrific thing. It leaves families just in limbo.
And it has to have a profound effect on those families, having to live day after day, knowing that part of their family has been ripped away and they will never be reunited.
Well, look what happened in Cleveland when they found the three girls in the house in Cleveland. I'm sure there were families all over the country who had missing family members who wondered if their loved one was being held captive like that somewhere and if someday they would escape and come home. There are just no answers. There's no clarity about the situation. There's no grave to visit. There's no funeral where your friends come and offer their condolences. Your daughter has just disappeared, and she's gone, and you don't know when or if she'll ever be back.
An open wound.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
The bodies of Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw, are those discovered? Because there's a question there, isn't there, with Renee Johnson's body?
Well, Sharon's body, her remains, aren't found until the next year. And they're found in a kind of a bayou area off the coastline near a small town. And so once they find Sharon's body and identify it as hers, well, then the question is, where's Renee? So they go back out looking for Renee. And they find parts of Renee, but not some bones, but not all of her remains. And that brings back, they recall that earlier that year, the year before, there was another body found in that area, one that they thought was that of a teenage boy. And that body had been decapitated. And what was found of Renee, mainly what was found of Renee, was her skull. So a lot of people wondered if it could have been Renee Johnson's body that was out there and that was actually found months earlier.
Were they able to do testing to verify this?
You know, back then, Aaron, in this pre-DNA era, it was pretty hard. There are only actually a couple of bones on the body that they can look at and determine sex. One is the skull, and they did have the skull, but it was not found with the body. And the other is the pelvis. And the medical examiner who had done the autopsy on the remains that were found months earlier determined, or in his opinion, that was a male body because of the pelvis, the way the pelvis was formed. So, but it's hard. It's really hard. I don't believe that was Renee Johnson's body because I did take both those autopsies to a retired medical examiner, and he pointed out that there was one too many femur bones. So, and he told me that he thought it was pretty clear usually from a pelvis if it was male or female. So he thought that it actually probably was a male body that was found out there before. But that brings up the question, who is this boy? And how is his death, tied to the deaths of the girls? Because their bodies were found in very close proximity.
Now, that's something that I don't think could be overstated, which is where these remains are found, it's quite clear that whoever has been committing these murders has plenty of time and opportunity and not really any worry about being interrupted.
Well, the bodies are all found. Galveston has a lot of water, not just the coastline, but a lot of bayous and canals. And so there's a lot of water to dispose of bodies in. And it back in that era, it's built up a lot more today. But back in that era, there were a lot of undeveloped areas, especially along I-45 with all the small towns. So there were a lot of places to hide a body. So as you said, there was just a lot of opportunity to conceal what he was doing.
Yes, because when they investigate and they look at how these victims were murdered, because on some of these, it's quite obvious what happened. They can tell that probably he was able to take his time, right? Because there are so many places that you could go to that just there's really no traffic. And then in those same areas, there's plenty of water. So this person could commit murder and dispose of a body. And this is why it's so difficult to close these cases.
Well, stranger killings are hard anyway, because there's no relationship between the victim and the killer to explore any known link between them. So they're very difficult. Back in the 70s and with these girls, it was even harder. And then these were in small towns, Aaron. So, when Sharon Shaw and Renee Johnson, when their bodies are found in this little town along the coastline north of Galveston, that police department had never had a murder case before, hadn't had one in 30 years. And suddenly they've got a double murder. Well, they didn't know what to do. It's a lot of these communities, the law enforcement just was not prepared for what was happening.
Now, I would say it's 1973, there's a man who is arrested for the murders of Sharon Shaw and Renee Johnson.
Well, yeah, Michael Lloyd Self. And this actually, I think, makes all of this more tragic. He's a gas station attendant. Back then, they didn't have self-serve yet. And he works near NASA, near the Johnson Space Center in a station there. And he's kind of a law enforcement hanger-on, spent a lot of time going to the police station and everything, and worked as a volunteer firefighter. He'd had some run-ins with the law. He'd been caught peeping in a window at one point and had done some other things. And he was always, the kids in that era called him Slow Mike, because he seemed to have some mental deficits. And he was tried, he was arrested, tried, and convicted on the murders. What he had always said of those two murders of Sharon Shaw and Renee Johnson, what he had always said was that he was forced into confessing, and the only evidence against him was his confession, because the police chief at the time played Russian roulette to get him to confess.
Well, let's go through this. The sheriff you're talking about is Donald Ray Morris.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure everyone knows, but Russian roulette is where you empty out the cartridges from a gun and place one bullet into the cartridge and you spin it. Mm-hmm. And then you place it to someone's head and you pull the trigger. And of course, if the bullet doesn't fire, they've made it through round one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What Mike Lloyd Self always said was that he was scared to death of Morris, that Morris was crazy.
So Morris was able to get this case closed, well, at least the murders of Sharon Shaw and Renee Johnson, because of his success with Mike Self. Mike Self is incarcerated for these murders, so they can close the case. And those murders are considered solved, correct? But but Morris may just be crazy. What happens with Morris later on that lets us know that perhaps this guy is not quite right?
Well, Morris and two of his friends who were also on the police department at that time end up getting arrested and convicted on a string of bank robberies and end up spending time in a federal penitentiary. And it turns out that this was all going on during the time that they were working on the Sean Johnson murders and, you know, getting up on the stand to testify against Mike Lloyd Self.
While committing their own crimes.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a question here, and it continues today, on whether or not Mike Self was actually guilty. Now, we know the court found him guilty, but in real terms, did this man really kill these women? There's a real question there, because while he's held and he goes through the court system, more people are murdered.
The killing continues. And while all of while he's in jail and all of this is happening, he even at the end, he'd been in prison and could have gotten out if he'd been willing to go before the parole board and admit that he had killed or said that he had killed the girls and asked for forgiveness and said that he was sorry. But throughout it all, Mike Lloyd Self always said that he was not the one, that he had not killed the two girls.
Yes, he was considered a bit odd, but he wasn't a killer.
I don't think he was. And most of the people I interviewed for the book didn't believe that he was. His first confession actually did not match the physical evidence.
And he also had other law enforcement officers agree that they felt he wasn't involved either.
And they said that they saw him being, you know, mistreated and abused during the confession, during the interview with the police.
And what does that say, that there can be this evidence that someone isn't guilty, that they were actually coerced, but they remain in prison, and in Mike Self's case, he dies in prison? What does that say?
You know, it's incredibly sad, and nowadays you need more than just a confession. You can't put someone in prison based on just a confession. We now understand that some people will confess when they are not guilty. But back then, that wasn't the law, and it's just horrific, but he did. He spent his life in prison and died in prison.
Now, there are, I believe, four more murders committed while Self is going through his ordeal. And one of those is Kimberly Ray Pitchford on January 3rd of 1973. She disappears.
Well, she does. She's 16 years old, and she walks outside after she finishes her driving class. And she's supposed to call her parents for a ride home. She's learning, you know, she's going through driver's ed, and she never calls, and she disappears like the others. Right before that, two of the other girls disappeared, Maria Johnson and Debbie Ackerman on the island. They were both 15. They were last seen getting into a white van. So now we're up to eight girls have disappeared from 1971 through 1973.
Right, that's the second pair, Maria Johnson and Debbie Ackerman. They're both 15. They disappear on November 15th, 1971.
And their bodies are found in water again, just like Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw and Brenda Jones and all the others. They're found out in an oil field in a kind of a creek that ran through the property, and there's a little bridge there. That's where the Johnson girl, Maria Johnson, and Debbie Ackerman are found. And Kimberly Pitchford's found in a ditch along the side of the road in the water. A couple of boys see her black coat that she had gotten for Christmas, kind of pushed up against the side of a fence, kind of flowing in the wind. And they get out of the car to go investigate, and they find this black coat. And when they look over, they see Kimberly's body in the water.
After that, another pair of girls disappear.
This time they're very young. The youngest is Brooks Bracewell, and she was just 12 years old. And the other is her best friend. All these girls disappeared with a best friend. And the Brooks friend is Georgia Gear, and she's 14. And they skipped school. And they were running around that day, and they were seen at a bunch of different places, including a convenience store. And at one point, they were seen playing football with a bunch of men out in front of a convenience store. And then they're just gone. Like the others, they're just gone. And their bodies aren't found for a long time. It's a matter of a couple of years.
There's such a large area to search. And there's probably there's no way to actually search all of it, given all the water, given the amount of land that you have to cover. It just seems like such a daunting task to even search.
I don't know if they had searched it, Aaron, if they would have found these girls, because most of them were nowhere near where they were taken from.
Right.
They were transported quite a distance. I don't know if it was before they were killed or after, but their bodies were dumped a considerable distance from where they were last seen.
But they were dumped in areas often around water.
Almost always around water. The person who did this understood that water could degrade the evidence.
And then Suzanne Bowers, who's also 12, what happened with her?
Well, you know, she was supposed to meet her friend down at the beach. And she was at her grandparents' house, and she asked her grandfather to take her down to the beach, but he told her to go ahead and take her bike. She had done that lots of times before. So she was going home to go get her swimsuit and her bike to go down to the beach to meet her friends. This was Memorial Weekend, and by now we're at 1977. So she left her grandparents' house, and it was only a short distance to her parents' house, a matter of a few blocks, but she never arrived at her parents' house. Somewhere between the grandparents' house and the parents' house, Suzanne disappeared. So that afternoon, her grandmother started calling around looking for her, calling her friends, calling everyone, and couldn't find her. And the family immediately called the police, and the police said the standard thing, which is that she must have run away. And there's a really sad quote in an old Galveston newspaper from May of 1977, where the grandmother says that Suzanne would not have run away, and that Suzanne had been saving her money to go on a school trip. And that all of that money was still sitting in her bedroom. She hadn't taken it with her, and she hadn't taken any of her things. But for a long time, the police weren't looking for Suzanne either.
But she had a friend, Sarah Groves, who definitely put in, she searched, and Suzanne's grandmother was also involved in searching.
Yeah, the family searched. The friends searched, but for a long time, the police didn't. And then her remains were found out in a field. This time it was out in a field.
It's very difficult because the grandfather had that opportunity to give her a ride, but really didn't think anything of saying, it's probably good for her to ride her bike.
Mm-hmm. Well, parents used to let their kids ride their bikes all over the place. I did when I was a kid. And you know, I remember staying out until way after dark at night when I was 12, 11, even 10 years old, playing with the kids in the neighborhood. Nowadays, people tend to put their kids in the car and take them places. And, you know, except for maybe playing in their yard or right around their home, they're supervised most of the time, which is a good thing, I think. But, you know, it's just sad that parents have to do this, that it's changed this way.
But Suzanne's murder gets sort of caught up because someone confesses to it, someone well known.
That's very true. This is during the Henry Lee Lucas time, and he is going around confessing to murders all over this part of the U.S. And here in Texas, he confessed to quite a few. And at one point, they asked him if he killed Suzanne Bowers, and they show him a picture of Suzanne Bowers. And he says, yep, he killed her. He did. But her friend that you mentioned earlier, Sarah, she doesn't believe it, because what she finds out is that what Lucas has told the police doesn't match at all what happened to Suzanne Bowers. So she starts to write Henry Lee Lucas, and she asks him, did you kill Sarah Bowers? Sends him a picture of Sarah, of Suzanne, and he writes her back, and he says, no, I didn't. I was just telling police that because they were doing things like giving me cigarettes and giving me better food.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
Yeah, and that's something I don't think people understand well enough, is that some people will just confess. You don't even really need a reason. People will just confess.
Well, they will, you know, and a lot of times with inmates, they just like to get out for a while. And by that time, Lucas was already in prison, you know, for other murders. So, and, you know, and it's a real attractive thing for law enforcement to be able to get additional confessions, because it clears cases. They've got these cases on the books, these cold cases that are unsolved. And if they can get somebody to confess to them, they can say it's a solved case and it's off their books.
There's someone that you come across who, I guess you could say, becomes the key to possibly understanding what happened to these young women. And his name is Fred Page. Can you tell us a bit about who Fred Page is?
Fred Page is a investigator at that point, a detective with the Galveston Police Department. And Debbie Ackerman, one of the girls, her mom has a friend, and the friend invites Page over to her apartment at a senior center at a nursing home, and shows him an old scrapbook with clippings in it from the disappearances and the murders of Maria Johnson and Debbie Ackerman, and asks him to please do an investigation and find out what happened to these girls. So Fred starts to, and the first thing he does is he goes over to Texas City, where some of these records are being kept in the police department there. And while he's talking to the people there about it, he finds out that in the 90s, there's an inmate in the Texas prison system who wrote letters to the district attorney's offices in Harris County, which is Houston, and Galveston County, and confessed to killing Ackerman and Johnson and the other girls.
Yes, he doesn't quite name all of them, but he gives enough information that they can put this together that he's talking about these 11 women.
And he included Sharon Shaw and Renee Johnson, the two girls that Michael Lloyd Self had spent his life in prison for killing.
Right, and these confessions were sent out in 1998.
They were, and Fred Page visited the woman in the nursing home, I think it was, what, about 2010 or so?
So Ed Bell is suddenly an interesting suspect, because as we've said before, people can just confess, but he seems to have some information on how these women died, and the information he has, well, it seems to match up better than other confessions have.
Well, Michael Lloyd self didn't even know how Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw died. He talked about hitting him over the head with a Coke bottle, and there was absolutely no indication on their skulls that there were any fractures or anything had happened like that to them. But on the other hand, Ed Bell, in his letter, described shooting Maria Johnson and Debbie Ackerman. And he talked about the angles of the shots. He talked about the guns with the ammunition that was used. And it all fit the crimes.
So what about Ed seems to suggest that this isn't a false lead? He is capable of doing this. He had a criminal history, correct?
Ed had a long history. That he was a very bright man. He was a graduate of Texas A&M University. He was working on a master's degree at Texas Tech when he was picked up the first time for exposing himself to a group of kids. And from that point forward, it happened repeatedly, and he ended up in the fall of 1970. So it's just right before these murders start, like within a year of these murders starting, he's brought to UTMB, that's the University of Texas Medical Branch on Galveston Island, and put into their psychiatric program there for sex offenders. So he arrives on the island right before these killings start. And while he's on the island, Ed's very bright, he's a businessman, he buys into a surf shop on the beach where a lot of the girls are going, where a lot of the teenagers are frequenting, and, you know, is moving in the same circles with a lot of the girls that ended up missing.
And he was known to expose himself to more than one girl at a time sometimes.
He was. And actually, that was his demise in 1978. So this is the year after Suzanne Bowers is killed. Ed is out on the street exposing himself to a group of kids when a guy who'd been in Vietnam walks out.
Larry Dickens.
Is it or Dixon? I'm sorry, you might be right.
You have a lot of knowledge on this case, but I'm sure you're working on new stuff all the time.
Yeah, no, I'm actually two books farther in. I'm working on two more. You know, I've got another book I finished, and I'm working on one right now.
But, well, I totally understand is all I'm saying.
Well, Larry walks out to stop Ed Bell from exposing himself to the kids, and Ed pulls out a gun from the back of the truck. After Larry takes his keys, he's waiting for the police to arrive, and Ed starts shooting Larry, and he shoots him and kills him.
Yeah, I think he hits him four times, correct? And Larry tries to head back towards the garage.
And at the end, Ed is standing over Larry's body. This is the amount of rage this man has. He's standing over Larry's body, and he shoots him right through the head.
With a rifle, correct?
Mm-hmm. I believe that's true, yeah.
This is a horrific crime, and of course, he takes off.
He does, but they do get him, and they bring him back, and Larry's mom and sister both identify him as the killer, and he's taken in and booked, and for some reason I don't understand, he gets bail, and gets out on bail, and sells all of his possessions here in the Gulf Coast, and takes off. He skips bail, and he's gone.
He ends up with, because of selling off his boats and other items, he ends up with more than $140,000.
Mm-hmm. And this is a lot of money in 1978, Aaron. I mean, it's a lot of money today, but back then, that's really a lot of money.
There's no telling where he could have ended up. And thankfully, America's Most Wanted aired an episode on him about his murder of Larry Dickens. And it aired in December of 1992. And it really stood out to me because Matthew McConaughey plays Larry Dickens in the recreation.
Yeah, Larry's sister told me that it was actually McConaughey's first role on television. So it's kind of interesting. But they find him. Then they start getting tips and then they find out that Ed is down in South America.
Yes, in Panama.
In Panama. And he's living down there. He's married and he's got a business going down there. And they go down and get him and bring him back. And they try him for Larry's murder. And he gets a life sentence and he's put in a Texas prison.
Yeah, 70 years. In 2011, the Houston Chronicle has a reporter. And how do you pronounce her name?
It's Lisa Olson.
Lisa Olson. Okay. So Houston Chronicle reporter Lisa Olson interviews him, and he admits to the 11 murders, and he says they're the 11 who went to heaven.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the girls. And I saw that, actually. That's when I started working on the book. But it's so interesting that all of this time, now by that time, he had already written the letters to the district attorneys.
Yes.
And Fred Page had already compiled a whole dossier on Ed Bell and the similarities between the cases and Bell. There were things like the two of the girls, Maria Johnson and Debbie Ackerman, they were last seen getting into a white van when they disappeared in November 1971. Well, Fred Page unearthed some documents from an arrest of Bell's for exposing himself, and the car he's in that day is a white van. That's the vehicle he's driving. So there were a lot of indications that there were overlaps. Two of the girls were found not far from property that Ed owned.
And Suzanne Bowers, her grandparents' house was right next to an employee of Bell's.
It backed right up to the house of a man who was living with his parents, and he was working for Ed Bell as a captain on one of the boats that Ed had at that time. Ed had boats that he was sending out to help supply the oil rigs out in the Gulf. He had quite a few businesses going. He was very successful.
Yeah, he was fond of saying that he always had rolls of money.
Mm-hmm. I think it was true.
Now, we should say that you were able to speak with Bell, although it took you a little while to get the chance to interview him, but you did finally get to interview him on a few occasions, correct?
I did. Yeah, I think I talked to him three times. He's in prison, and I interviewed quite a few of the suspects that are in the book. But I went up. The first thing Ed said to me, I walked in and sat down, and they brought him in, and he sat down, and he looked at me, and he said, you know, I could cut your head off right now, and they couldn't do anything to me. Luckily, there was a barrier between us that included a plexiglass shield, so I wasn't too worried about it. But it was such an odd interview. It's one of the strangest I've ever had, Aaron.
Yes, you make that clear in the book, and I like how you allow him to speak, but you also try a number of times to get him to talk to you about these girls. And he's very steadfast in his belief that something needs to be done about what happened to him first before anything else can happen.
Well, Ed's an interesting guy because he at one point goes into something akin to a mild rage while I'm talking to him. Actually, he did that a couple of times. But at one point, he goes into one against religion and God and how he doesn't believe in anything past the time here on earth. Yet throughout my entire conversation with him, he was talking about, he was really exonerating himself of any responsibility for anything that he had done, blaming it on people that he said had coerced him into doing it, starting from the time that he was a child. So it was just this really strange and really an incredible interview. There were times when he talked about killing the girls when he would get so animated and so in the moment that it was almost like he was back there again, out in those fields.
I know you can't say for certain that this Ed Bell is responsible for these murders, but there's definitely a feeling that of all of the suspects, and due to the research and the coincidences about where he lived and the business he was involved in and where these bodies were found, that he had the motive and the opportunity to commit these murders.
You know, I think that's all very true. And, Aaron, he just knows so much about these killings. We wrote, I did go to see him, I think, two or three times. But we wrote for at least a year, maybe 2 years. And during that time, he wrote me letters where he described what the girls were wearing. He told me about Colette Wilson's t-shirt with the Mickey Mouse on it. He told me what color her shorts were. He remembered the colors of Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson's blouses that they had on the day they were murdered. Now, the problem is that a lot of that had been reported back in the newspaper back in the 1970s. But how would he remember from 1971 what he read in a newspaper article when I'm talking to him in 2012?
That's something that really stood out to me in the book, is that that really drove the point home. It seems like he's the guy.
Mm-hmm. I believe that it's very likely that Ed Bell killed all 11 of the girls. He repeatedly told me that he had done bad things, and I'd say, what bad things have you done, Ed? And he'd say, you know, the 12 people I killed. It was the girls plus, you know, Larry. So, you know, he was really open about it. The problem is that he does have some type of a psychiatric condition, which makes things a little muddy. And there's also the fact that he'll talk to me, but he refuses to talk to law enforcement.
Well, I do want to say that this is a fantastic book, and I like how you really try to explore these victims as well as their families, the searches they conduct, despite law enforcement's lack of assistance, and the different suspects, and the hard work that people have done, both regular citizens as well as law enforcement later, who try to find answers in these cases, because this does span three decades. And so there are many stories in here that we just couldn't get to in the short amount of time that we had tonight. But it's something I would urge people to pick up and read, because this really does explore what true crime is all about. The pain, the loss, and the search for answers, and suspects who might seem like they're the ones, and then you find out later that they're not. Some of these characters in here, you couldn't make them up. The sheriff, Morris, Ed mm-hmm. Bell, so many of these characters are just unbelievable, and they'll really stick with you. So I think people will get a lot out of this book.
Well, thanks, Aaron. I don't know if I'll ever write another book like Deliver Us Again. This was quite a commitment, but it was really fascinating to work on.
Right. I remember when the book came out, I believe I friended you on Facebook back then. And I was actually thinking, when I was reading about what it concerned, I thought, I don't know if I'll be able to read this book. I don't know how you could write a book spanning that many decades with different killers and different victims. But you pulled it off, I would say, because it kept my interest the entire time.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank you for joining me tonight. I would like to give you this opportunity to plug anything else that you have upcoming, if you have an appearance somewhere, or if you have a book coming out, or a book that you just released that you'd like to mention.
Well, I have one coming out in September. It's called Possessed, and it's on the Texas Stiletto murder case from here in Houston, the Anna Trujillo case. Anna killed a man, a scientist, a University of Houston professor named Stefan Anderson, and used her stiletto heel to do it. And it's just, it turned out, I didn't know what I was getting into again. I never do with the books. You know, you go in and you think you know what's going on, and then you get into the cases and there are all kinds of things going on. But it just turned out to be a fascinating case to work on.
Well, thank you again, and hopefully we'll talk again sometime.
Thank you, Aaron. I'd enjoy that. Thank you very much.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all 6 episodes of Part 1 and watching along with Part 2 as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.